From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we talk about why God may love dinosaurs, a particularly moving journey through Siberia, and some bad, bad wolves.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I don't actually know how these introductions start, but I thought I'd steal it from
Jan. You're not taking this one.
Way.
You did it last time and it was absolutely
Jan, last
horrible.
Time.
Hey everybody and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I'm one of your hosts, Jan.
No, one second. Why don't I get a turn? I want to do this.
Go ahead. Give
it's
Alex a chance to start.
What do you mean you got a turn?
No, you don't get a turn.
Hello, everyone,
welcome to the Weekly Quack. I'm one of your hosts, Jan Bigas, and with me today is Alexander Sander Radcliffe III, whose name must be read from North Undershire, 0.63, Bordy McBoardface, ASI3, and of course, Jesse Anderson.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
Yeah, 100%, sir. Absolutely happy. My pleasure.
Wait, wasn't he Jan?
Oh, you're Jan. Who's Jan?
No.
Either way, I am Jesse Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode. If you're interested in having a conversation with us, you can swing over to theweeklyquack.com. And I don't know what else I'm supposed to say at this point. So, Jan, you want to take it
away? Something about ratings and five-star or one-star ratings. It's never entirely clear to me.
All that being said, this podcast is going to be broken down into three core segments, Self or Shell or Shelf or Sell, where we talk about games that are either entering or leaving our collection, The Medley Minute, a quick respite from the chaos of the world, where we talk about things that are lulling around the Quackalope Pond, and On the Radar, where we talk about what's happening mostly around Kickstarter, which is okay and interesting, but you should probably avoid because it'll convince you to spend money.
Also, at the end of every show, we take some time to go through audience feedback and questions. We actually did our last episode dedicated to all questions.
My least favorite segment.
Oh, lies. We did an entire episode dedicated to your questions, so we always look forward to getting them. But before we get going, if you like what you hear, be sure to leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts.
Are you still shilling
you get your
for
podcast
ratings?
From.
Can we
Why
just move on?
Ratings?
Can we just move on
we
already?
We always have to shill for ratings. That's how we grow. Jesse, you need to understand that the only way that we're going
to
grow this podcast
what I need
is
to
by
understand,
getting ratings.
Jan, is the game you're bringing to the table.
Oh my God. Today, I am going to bring in to Shelf or Sale, Air, Land,
you're
and Sea.
You're keeping it because it's a gem of a game that fits into a 12-card packet, and you're probably carrying it in your back pocket at the moment. But continue, good sir.
Jesse, you're so, so close. It's not 12 cards. I believe it's 18 cards.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about this because not everybody might be aware what this is. So first of all, this is designed by John Perry and published by Arcane Wonders. And in Air, Land, and Sea is a two-player card game of area control and bluffing. The objective is to control two of the three theaters of war, aka areas, after both players have played all of their battle cards.
That's actually the term that's used. I mean, they really are described as theaters of war, like stages that you're setting up.
Or you convince your opponent to withdraw. At the beginning of each round, players are dealt a hand of six cards, which they must decide how to use. You either play them face down, and these can be played anywhere amongst the theaters, or you play them face up to activate their special abilities, but they have to be placed in a particular theater. The advantage of placing them face up is that you usually get higher values in the numbers that you're going to be using later on, and if you play them face down, you'll get a standard two. Now, once all cards are played on each area or theater, or a player withdraws, it's time to count the points. Whoever has the most points in each area is going to score victory points based on different criteria. It usually depends on how many cards are still left in each player's hand. The first player to reach 12 victory points will win the war.
That might be the most confusing introduction I've ever heard to a card to a game that only has 18 cards.
Jesse, I think it has 12 cards.
Oh, okay, thank you.
What do you mean? This is all of it from the publisher's description.
No. The very, very quick way I would describe this game, because like Jesse said, this 18-card game is an absolute gem. I love it. I adore it.
12.
It's my collection. No, 18. I'm pretty sure with that. So the way you play this game ultimately is you're going to have a bunch of cards that you're going to pull. You're going to draw six cards each. You're going to play them down to three different theaters using a variety of different abilities to kind of mesh and make things happen the way you want them to happen. The game relies on a unique mechanism where you can withdraw early to give your opponent fewer points, which is a big part of the game, knowing when you're winning, when to push that advantage and knowing when to walk away. Whoever gets to 12 points first wins the game.
Listen, this is going to be a thematic showdown between two different players, doing your very best to squabble in air, land, and sea, the title of the game. You'll have different resources, tanks and air, you know, airplanes and other types of vehicles that could be equipped in all of these regions that'll provide special effects, bonuses, and different types of abilities. The object of the game is not to win every single battle, but to understand the dynamic of the war as a whole, retreating where you need to, re-engaging where you have to, until finally you've won the entire war instead of a single showdown.
Why exactly are we rehashing what I just said for the third time now?
It's the fourth time.
And you're keeping this game.
Okay. So, Jesse, we have your vote. And Alex, we have your vote as well.
Yeah, you absolutely keep this game.
Yeah, you're both right. This game is absolutely awesome. So the first time that I ever played this game, I've actually only played this about 2 to 3 times, and it was with Jeremy Howard. We just decided one day, go online and play some games together. And in between some of the larger games, that was the day that I played The Magnificent also with him. We decided to bring out Air, Land, and Sea. He was very excited about it. He had been talking it up for a little bit, and he wanted to show it to me. And I'm very glad that he did. This was a game that actually you, Jesse, you had brought onto the channel at some point, and you played this with Matt, but I never got the opportunity to play it with you or with Matt, and I was always kind of curious, because I'm a big fan of these kind of dueling card games that are very, very small in their footprint. I've also been a really big fan of Crimson Company, which is similar, and we also played Omen, or the Omen series. I think the one that we played was
from
specifically
Colossal
the
Games.
One with the Egyptian guy.
And of course, you adore Battleline and Hanamakoji, I assume.
Actually, no, I have not played either of those, unfortunately.
Oh, you're missing out, sir.
So I've always liked this style of game. But what Air, Land, and Sea did, I'm not exactly sure how to put it into words, but I'm going to do my very best. I think one of the best things about Air, Land, and Sea is that it was able to convey the idea of an actual conflict through a really accessible means, right? I feel that in Crimson Company and Omen and these other series, there might be a few additional elements in there that take away from the core premise of just fighting it out in this tug of war in these three different areas. And the way that the powers and abilities apply in Air, Land, and Sea just made it a lot more engaging for me, for whatever reason that is. In addition to that, yes, as both of you have said many times now, it's either 12, 18, we don't know the number, but it still feels... six cards in each person's hand, it still feels very tactical and thinky, which is surprising for such a small box game. The way that the powers interact with each other and the level of strategy that you get every time you're dealt a hand of six cards is really surprising. The best thing about this game, which I think the others don't do as well, is that because the deck of cards is so small, it becomes more of a bluffing game, which is one of the things that I used to describe this game as. And that adds such an interesting layer of strategic depth in there. Because what you're doing is that you're not really trying to play the highest cards on each one of the theaters. You're trying to anticipate what your opponent might do. Okay, that I think that was a really interesting conceit that Air, Land, and Sea had. And finally, I think that the way that the rewards and the point scoring are, that you're constantly trying to get to 12 and it's almost like a race, that also keeps it very refreshing and light and quick-paced, which again, I really liked about this game. Overall, really solid little package, very cheap and economical and very easy to get as well. If you like two-player card games and you're looking for something new, I definitely recommend this one.
See, it's interesting to me because this is the second time you described the game and avoided the part that I find most intriguing about the game, which is that withdrawal aspect. It's not one of the things you're focusing on, but to me, it's my favorite part that makes this game unique, that aspect that every battle ultimately can win you 6 points, which means two battles can win you the game. Mm-hmm. But knowing that you've lost, knowing that you're not going to win, or just having enough of a strategic foresight to understand when to push and when to withdraw means you can walk away losing as few as 2 points per battle. The earlier the withdraw, the less points you give your opponent. And so understanding, you could literally just draw a hand of cards, look at your hand and be like, nope, not going to win this one, and walk away giving your opponent 2 points. Or you can do what most people want to do, which is nonetheless try to double down on a bad hand, which is it's a mistake. But I love that Air, Land, and Sea gives you that option, and no other game that I know of really does.
Yeah, it's all about that bluffing, which is what I love about it. And you're 100% right. This game in particular is all about bluffing, like I said in my description. And I think I am 100% doing it the service if we don't mention that withdrawal mechanic, because it is what sets this apart amongst all the other games that are similar that we've already mentioned.
So we've all agreed that we like this game for various different reasons. We've all done our very best to describe it to the audience, and at $15 to $12, really, there's almost no reason why people
I believe it's $18
wouldn't pick up this. I mean, it depends on who you're depends on who you're shopping it from. If you buy it from Board Game Co., it'll probably be, you know, a little bit higher than average.
All that being said,
Alex,
burn.
What are you bringing to the table?
An excellent question. This week, I am bringing in God's Love Dinosaurs.
Awesome. And I am bringing in...
No, go ahead.
I'm bringing in the Forbidden series. Now, Jan, though, we have a little bit of time to get a longer insight on what exactly Alex might think about God's Love Dinosaurs. The Forbidden series is going to start with Forbidden Island, then go to Forbidden Desert, and finally Forbidden Sky. This is going to be an introductory series of games that really promote the idea of cooperative teamwork. You're rolling dice, moving around a region, stacking up various threats, and doing your very best to solve a different puzzle. In Forbidden Island, you're doing your very best to escape the island, I believe, before the ocean tide rises. In Forbidden Desert, the desert is going to be sweeping in with a sandstorm that's slowly uncovering and also revealing little parts to an airship that'll help you get off of this location. And then finally, in Forbidden Sky, you're going to be doing your very best to build an electronic machine of some sorts, connecting little metallic parts to one another and trying to light up this launch pad that'll allow you to journey off into the distant sky. All of these are games that, when I first entered the hobby, were highly recommended. And all of these, well, two of these are games that I still own in my collection. Now, do you all want some flavor text, or have I given you enough?
Just to be clear, are we treating this series as a complete set? You're either getting rid of or keeping all?
I am treating, well, I'll let you know, I don't own Sky. So that one I'm familiar with, but I'm bringing them in as complete set. Because, I don't know, I like collecting things together.
Okay, so it is a bit harder to answer the question without context, because Forbidden Desert is by far the best of the series. Forbidden Desert does manage to give you the most intricate decisions to be made, and it gives you a really rewarding variant to Pandemic. Whereas Forbidden Island is often thought of as being a lighter, more gateway Pandemic, and Forbidden Sky is often thought of as a game that was a little too clever for its own good without adding enough to the genre. Forbidden Desert is the one that shines, and so that's what makes it tough for me. But given that you are lumping them together, I am inclined to believe that you're getting rid of both. The alternative is that you're keeping both because they're great. They're both great gateway options, both good entry games to people who you want to introduce gaming to. And I could very much see that, but I think I'm going to say you're getting rid of both.
And so I also find this pretty fascinating that you decided to bring this series. First of all, I had no idea that you've even played these before. And taking into consideration all of the other co-ops that we've been recently bringing into the channel and also just playing by your own accord, for example, Spirit Island, I don't see space for this genre for you to have so much variability in. I think that you would probably choose any of the other cooperative games that we've talked about in the past on top of the Forbidden series. Honestly, I think you probably let go and said goodbye to the Forbidden series very early on in the process, or maybe I'm just completely off. I'm going to say that you're selling this one, Jesse, 100%.
I have never liked these games. Not only currently, I don't, I could advocate on behalf of them for a certain group of players, and I understand why they position themselves as introductory games and cooperative games in this genre, but I would be remiss to even recommend these games to people.
That's a pretty extreme and harsh statement.
Yeah, it is pretty extreme. I've played every single one. I have played Forbidden Desert and Forbidden Island multiple times. I purchased them because they were highly recommended when I first got into the space, and they just don't click for me. I don't like the open-ended nature of the cooperative work. I don't. And granted, cooperative games in this style aren't really my forte. I just overall haven't enjoyed the experience that these bring to the table. I've never really found them, even as an introductory gamer, I've never really found them as a rewarding gameplay environment.
And why is that exactly, Jesse? Because I think the first one that I ever played, and the only one, unfortunately, that I was ever able to play was Forbidden Island. And I remember that the the constant threat of these tiles flipping over and that the clock, that everything is just kind of closing in around you, was pretty exciting for an initial gamer. And the way that, like, the puzzle set collection and you being able to resuscitate some of these tiles and then incorporate special player powers, there were a lot of little things in there that helped me become, get to the point where I am today.
My repeat experience has always lended itself in these titles, like most cooperative games do, to someone just min-maxing an understanding of the table, and there being clearly and obviously poor choices and good choices. And if you start making poor choices, you'll lose, and if you start making good choices, either the odds will work against you or you'll win. And so from the very start, I just didn't like the atmosphere that it set.
So it sounds more like you have a critique around just straight up and traditional cooperative games, because at the end of the day, Forbidden Island and the Forbidden series, I feel, is a much more bare bones experience of what a cooperative game is than all of the others that we're probably used to and that we probably enjoy more, right?
Cooperative games are typically not my forte. I will readily admit that. But I've been cleaning through and going through my board games in preparation for a move that's happening, and I stumbled across these in my closet and asked myself the question, why do I even still have them?
And Alex, where do you fall on this? Because you definitely have a lot more experience than I do with this series. Do you agree with me that these are still really good introductory games into the board game genre as a whole? Or do you feel that after all the innovations that we've seen in cooperative games, that the quarterbacking in this, as Jesse is implying, is just too apparent?
So I think neither of these games need to be owned by Jesse for the sake of Jesse. They're not games that are necessarily going to appeal to his own collection. But the reason I referenced my comment earlier about how he might be holding on to them for others is Jesse historically has appreciated and enjoyed having games just for the sake of introducing others to those games.
Sure.
And in that context, these are both excellent choices. I think Jesse has his own bias against them, but I mean, the industry can't lie. These games have consistently been recommended again and again and again to people. I mean, Jesse, do you have
They were recommended to me when I first entered the hobby. I got them through recommendations and didn't enjoy them due to it.
But how many people do you think own these games respectively on BoardGameGeek? That's just people who marked them as owned, not actually owned.
Way too many.
Take a gander.
I gander 11,000.
Forbidden Island has 72,000 people who have it marked as owned. This is a light game. Forbidden Desert has 40...
I do not mind the existence of these games. I could even, like I said, advocate for why people enjoy them. I'm saying in my own experience and my own approach to these games, they're never ones that come to the tip of my tongue when I'm trying to recommend someone to enter this hobby space.
So Jesse, that's exactly the question that I wanted to ask you. Considering the cooperative elements that you're seeing here, the movement pieces, the idea of dealing with threats actively on a board, but also in an introductory setting, is there any other game that you can think of that you could potentially recommend over the Forbidden Island series?
That is a hard question, and without maybe a bit of prep, I think it would be easier for me to answer if I was able to like scout through my collection again. I would reference and point to some of the RPGs that I've played as cooperative experiences that have been positive. I would reference to Kingdom Rush and the way it starts introducing you into a cooperative setting and a puzzle that you're solving together. I would even say that the base level of Spirit Island, while a heavier game across the board, could still be a more positive experience for myself than either of these games were when I first got into the hobby space.
You know what, Jesse? Like, I would actually just recommend straight up Pandemic. There's also The Crew. If we're talking about intro cooperative games, Mechs versus Minions.
Okay.
Last Bastion.
I also didn't love The Crew. I didn't love The Crew. I have only played Pandemic once. I'm a
big fan. Like, Alex, Hanabi also is a really good one for a more party game setting. You got just one. Alex, any others you want to throw in there? Maybe Horrified?
I mean, no, we can throw in a few. We could throw in Kingdom Death Monster, Townsfolk Tussle. There's a whole bunch of cooperative games out there.
Introductory. What do you mean?
Introductory. Kingdom Death Monster was Jesse's first game. That's introductory.
That's true. It is how I entered this hobby.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, Alex, I promise I won't interrupt you. What did you bring in to Shelf or Sell?
Today I'm bringing in Gods Love Dinosaurs.
We already told him. He's bringing in Gods Love Dinosaurs. Now, Gods Love Dinosaurs is going to be an adorable little tile-laying game where you're trying to grow a harvest of different animal creatures and have them consumed by vicious raptors.
So, Gods Love Dinosaurs, like Jesse said, is a game about building your own ecosystem. It's a game in which you're going to be drafting these tiles in order to build out various different types of prey, effectively. And then along the way, you have to generate predators as well, different lions and eagles that are going to be trying to attack the various prey in order to generate more lions and eagles, because more lions and eagles in your domain is exactly what an ecosystem looks like. And then from there, the dinosaurs are going to activate eating the prey, which is going to generate more dinosaur eggs. It's a
also,
little beautiful cycle
what an
of
ecosystem
life.
Looks like.
Exactly. This is an ecosystem in play. This is basically how I envision things playing out in a general day-to-day life. It's the circle of life. And it involves dinosaurs and prey and dinosaurs and everything else. And then along the way, or not really along the way so much, it's at the end of the game, whoever has most efficiently eaten the most prey and therefore generated the most predators, which have therefore then been consumed by the most dinosaurs, leading to the most births of various dinosaur eggs and dinosaurs, will add up to the most amount of points at the end of the game, and that player will win the game.
Okay, and Alex, how many times have you played this, and with how many players so far?
That's an excellent question. I have played this a few times now, and I've played it with 4 players every time.
Okay. And so, I guess my next question is going to be, how long did it play for?
How is that a relevant question to anything?
What do you mean? Like, a lot of games can go over their allotted amount.
I don't remember offhand, probably in the hour-long range.
48.53 seconds, Jan.
Okay, I hear you. But seriously, like, this type of game, for what it is, it's usually better in short bursts, so that's why I'm asking my question in the first place.
Oh, let me try again. Ask the question again.
Oh, okay. How many hours did you play this game?
Oh, each of these games are around 7.5 hours. It's just way too long for what the game is.
Yep. You're all horrible. Okay. Alex, so here's the thing. I'm a little bit conflicted. I think I would be very surprised if you did decide to keep this one. Not because it's a bad game or anything. I actually really enjoyed my play. I thought that the way that the ecosystems worked out and the way that all the creatures interacted was actually really, really fun. But for some reason, I can't see you keeping this one right now.
So you've played this one and you're keeping it?
I don't own it.
Oh, would you own it?
I own it.
I don't know if I would.
I currently own it.
And what do you think of it, Jesse?
He hates it.
I thought it was very nice. I've lended it to a friend.
How many times have you played it, Jesse?
I've played it once.
Excellent. And you, Jan?
I also played it once.
And I'm differing with Jan's opinion. I think you actually enjoyed this game.
I hear. And what are your votes?
I think you're keeping it.
Jan, you?
Yeah, you're selling this.
You are right, Jan. I am getting rid of this game.
Yes!
And here's the key thing. I like this game. I do. I genuinely do.
Why are you getting rid of it?
Because yeah, exactly. I think it's the same exact game every single time you play it. It doesn't have the very... That's why I was very curious how often the two of you have played this game. I think this game is begging for some sort of expansion or something that makes the game interesting and fresh game to game.
Your mustache is the same every time I see it, too, and I'm not getting rid of that.
Funny you should say that, Jesse. I have a bad habit of frequently messing with my facial hair because I get bored of the way it looks. My wife is not happy when I mess with my facial hair, but I am frequently bored with things that remain the same. That is a consistent trait amongst myself.
Well, okay. I don't think we can be too hard on this game for this particular reason, because it's at the end of the day, it's a cheap game, and it's also actually like really, really fun for the type of abstract it is.
Absolutely beautiful. Love the mechanisms. Lots of fun.
I don't think you're wrong on this criticism, Alex, and I would venture to say that may be the element that hasn't made me fall in love with it. I think that if there was more opportunity to make the game messy, more creatures, more monsters, more dinosaurs, more animals to introduce to every single scenario and session, it may stand up a lot higher than it currently
does.
I completely
agree.
Almost like I feel it could almost benefit from even just having a set of cards where the various 5 creatures in play, or 6 if you include the dinosaurs,
interact in a different way.
All have a different set of cards. So maybe each one has 3 different cards that give them a slight spin. And that way, depending on which configuration of different cards you use, you're actually playing a slightly different game every single time. That would be enough
because
to mix it up.
The core system and mechanics of this game
are beautiful.
The little mathematical puzzle and tile laying is really interesting. And when I'm talking about introductory games, I handed this one to a friend as an introductory game. It was one that I was willing and ready to recommend.
Yeah, but I completely agree. It's most introductory
games don't last for 50 plays.
Yeah, and like Horror Fight, for example.
And like one of the things I like about it is how you genuinely do feel like you're building out an ecosystem. It really does give you that feel. Like, I have to manage my prey, I have to manage my predators, and ultimately I have to eat them all with my dinosaurs. It's a fun little puzzle each time you play it. It's just the same little puzzle each time you play it.
But okay, so here's the thing that I'm a little bit curious about. I feel that a lot of abstracts fall kind of into the same category. Like, what makes this particular game different from TAC, for example, right? In TAC, you're pretty much doing the same thing over and over. Like, what exactly...
It's a fair question.
Yeah,
sure.
What exactly are we missing from this game? Like, we have the drafting, we have different creatures. Like, what's
TAC
there?
TAC is an example. It's always going to be the same game, one after another.
So two things with TAC that make it different. First of all, with TAC is that every game is generally in the range of around 10 minutes, not in the range of an hour. So yep. The variability is very different in that sense. Then you start off, you rinse, you repeat, move to the next sequence. Secondly, and more importantly, in Gods Love Dinosaurs, most of what you're doing is building out your own engine. There is a little bit of interplay of who gets which tile first, but mostly you're building out your own engine every single time versus TAC. The mental
puzzle versus someone else.
It's insane. Mm-hmm. It's insane. You want that back and forth. If you're going to keep something dry...
Specifically Shira, who has beaten me at every game of TAC I've tried to play.
I'm looking forward to the next batch of plays in that sense. But yeah, if you're playing something that is going to be dry and the same every single time, I think it is very important that the interplay between the players be huge, because the interplay will be enough that it mixes up the experience. But if you're relying on the game to be less of an interplay, then you need the game to be the thing that mixes up the experience.
Yeah, so I've actually never thought of that or had kind of connected these dots before. But it does seem to be that whenever you're working with an abstract, the most popular types of abstracts that you're going to get are going to be those that are challenging you directly with another player, where you're having a lot more interaction. Like, for example, the top games here on BGG, you're going to have Azul, you're going to have Patchworks, Sagrada, Santorini, Go, Yinch, Hive, Onitama, and even War Chest. And the common denominator around all these games is that I can kind of affect what you're doing, and you can pretty much affect what I'm doing. And I felt that here in Gods Love Dinosaurs, there was some level of interaction, but it was definitely not as in your face as any of these other games.
So the only thing we need to improve this game is to give me permission for my dinosaurs to eat your bunny rabbits.
You know what? That might not be a horrible idea. I can't say for sure.
It'd be a very different game. I think variability when it comes to the experience and the puzzle that you're solving, making it a degree more complex, or at least allowing it to grow with the players, would very much enhance this game. That being said, it's not a bad game, and it's one that I would readily tell people that is, you know, that it's worth playing. I'd have to lean towards Alex that it probably doesn't stand up with sustained plays with the same group of people for an extended period of time.
Sure, but I'll once again make one last note of this, is that this is a really cheap game, and I feel that if people are genuinely interested in this idea of an ecosystem coming to life through an abstract form, I think Gods Love Dinosaurs is a really good one. Like, I would recommend it, and by the time that you're going to play this again and again, like, you're probably not going to get tired of it.
I've been tired of you for a while.
Settle down. It's time for our Medley Minute, a moment of respite before the rest of our show.
Wow, Jesse, that came out of nowhere. What the hell, man?
And speaking of things that came out of nowhere, I recently had the opportunity to play Bantam West. Bantam West is a game that completely and totally was not on my radar in the slightest. I genuinely had not heard of this thing at all. I had someone reach out to me and say, hey, have you played Bantam West? And I was like, no. And he set me up with the creator to play Bantam West.
In fact, I ended up
playing it along with Jesse. This is a game that's going to be coming to Kickstarter. Yes, you, Jesse. Jesse Anderson.
Yeah. Come on down.
Yeah, we played Bantam West together online, and I was thoroughly impressed with it. This is not going to be an in-depth anything, because this is, after all, the Medley Minute, but Bantam West is very much a Western sandbox-style game in which you get to craft your own little journey of figuring out what you need to do from, you know, becoming a better, you know, miner, from taking out various creatures and animals, attacking each other, building up your own sequence or your own unique goals, all in the effort to get victory points throughout the game in a very, very whimsical and appealing and beautifully built out sandbox Western adventure.
I think what you're trying to say, Alex, is Bantam West has more promise than we anticipated, and enough promise that we're telling you to pay attention. It should be on your radar.
Yeah, just keep your eyes peeled. And speaking of where to keep your eyes peeled, I believe both Jesse and I, both Quacklip and Board Game Co., will have coverage of this game as it's coming closer to its Kickstarter date.
We'll be sure to let you know.
And actually, one thing that I'm super curious about is how it's going to compete with Western Legends.
I would happily answer that as soon as I knew how Western Legends played.
Oh, well, okay.
Fair point.
Well, either way, I'm just going to go ahead and swinging with my medley minute. It is actually pretty gigantic. It seems like Great Western Trail is getting a second edition, and not just that, it's actually getting two other versions of the same game.
I saw that, and I really want to back it. I don't even know what Great Western Trail is.
Just to be clear, you said back it. I don't think it's on Kickstarter. I could be wrong.
I don't know where it is. Everything is a back it at this point because you're promising that you'll pay money for something that's coming in the future.
Okay, that's actually not horrible logic, but either way. So Great Western Trail, the second edition, is coming out now in 2021. But the newest editions, which is actually going to be Great Western Trail Argentina in 2022. And then we're going to have...
Oh, I love Argentina.
Great Western Trail New Zealand. Yeah,
and this is being done by Plan B Games, who have done the Century series as well as Azul. They have a good track record of being able to deliver multiple sequences of the same game with enough variations and differences. To your doorstep.
That all link together in an immaculate puzzle that makes you go, why do I own all of this? I never play it.
Well, yeah, but we don't know details yet. We just know that they're coming out with three different versions of this. And I'm not 100% sure what these versions are even going to be.
No, they said they're going with the same Ticket to Ride approach of a same core system with multiple maps and different variations each time.
Yeah, that's kind of fascinating. Yeah. Why?
It's just, I find it interesting and fascinating because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong if any of you know otherwise, but I think this will be the heaviest game we have ever seen that treatment of.
Yeah, you know what? That's actually 100% true. I don't think I've ever heard of a heavy Euro that gets like this in a Napoleon. What's that flavor
Napoleon,
of ice cream?
I believe is the one you're looking for.
That's the word. He was a very short man who wasn't actually that short that conquered most of Europe.
Yeah.
It's not Napoleon. It's like
Neapolitan.
Neapolitan. Yeah. That one.
It's a very different word from Napoleon.
Sure. Okay. Fine. Like the ice cream that has the three flavors. You got chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. Maybe it's probably going to be something like that. It's going to be the same thing, just slightly different.
Which looks so much better.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Which looks so much better.
It looks astoundingly better.
But the original Great Western Trail looks like someone took a 1997 video game and left it on your doorstep and you forgot to tell you to update
like
the graphics.
It's like a Sharpie at a frat party, Jan.
Okay, fine, but that's not the point. Like, the number one thing that we need to know about this is that apparently there's going to be new mechanics added to Great Western Trail.
Oh, so the game might actually be good now.
What? Okay, okay, first of all, Great Western Trail is amazing, and secondly, I feel that now my version is, like, incomplete, it's obsolete, it's like, who's going to use it now?
That. Just to be clear, Jan, you're saying that currently, before yesterday, you were unhappy with your copy of Great Western Trail, right?
Well, no, not yesterday. Like, yesterday I loved
it.
I just want
a yes or no answer to that. Yesterday, you were unhappy with your Great Western Trail, right?
No, I wasn't unhappy.
Okay, so today, you are unhappy with your copy of Great Western Trail.
Well, yes, of course, because now I feel it's outdated. Like, of course I'm going to be unhappy about this. What do you mean?
I'm beginning to see the real problem here, Jan, and I don't think it's Plan B Games.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw this out there. I don't currently own the old school version of Great Western Trail. I love the game. Jan owns it. Why should I get it? I'm totally getting all of these.
Oh, dude, I don't even know what I'm going to do. Like, I love this game. Probably me too.
And for the record, Alex, just to clarify the difference between humor and serious moments, this is now a serious moment. What do you mean it might actually be good now? Great Western Trail is an immaculate Euro game with a beautiful development.
It is
incredible.
I jest, but in all seriousness, so Great Western Trail for me is a game that I liked. I liked it enough to play it like six or seven times, which for a game of this length is really, really not a small thing at all. This is a a game that I enjoyed the premise, the puzzle and whatnot, but something about it didn't pull me in. I felt that the various mechanisms of the game was just a little too much going on, with a little bit less cohesiveness in a singular direction than I wanted. That at the end of the day, I liked it. Happy to play it again. We'll happily pull it out. Well, if you pull it out, I'll happily play it any single time. But eventually I moved on from it. The fact that they are giving it a mechanical refresh to a game that I did enjoy is to me actually something I'm interested in. I do plan on checking out this trilogy. I do plan on seeing whether one of them manages to knock that, you know, final nail down and cause it to be a game that will stay in my collection long term. So I'm happy with the news. And plus, of course, the artwork is significantly better and does not look like someone was drunk.
Okay, wait. First of all, like, the artwork in Great Western Trail is pretty nice. Like, have you seen the board? It's amazing.
Oh, I'll give you that the board is beautiful. The cover was off-putting.
Sure.
My question is, is it just a cover adaptation, or are they changing everything? My assumption is they're changing everything, and we'll have to wait for the final judgment to come in when we see it all in front of us.
Well, yes, it's going to be a full artwork reprint, and also the expansion is going to get it too.
All that being said, I am bringing in something that's really special to me. It's something that I think is a worthy cause. It's something that I've been...
Oh, God, is it RPGs
really
again?
...advocate for a long time. No, it's not RPGs.
Again?
It's not flavor text. Listen, okay.
Okay, is it Zine Quest again? Seriously.
There is a predominant feature in the board game media space.
Oh, God, it's RPGs.
Doing, let's say, subpar quality content. I mean, people rising in the ranks rapidly, I mean, gaining tons of subscribers and doing what would, you know, I would venture to guess, like, genuinely poor quality content. And
okay,
I'm
definitely Quackalope.
I'm very excited to see that someone is finally taking a step to improve, introduce gameplay.
Oh my gosh, are you...
And...
Wait, who is this? Oh,
and
is it
update
Alex?
Update their current equipment. After he listened to me the first time, and purchased a front-facing camera and a single light to film in his basement, one little muskrat by the name of Alexander Radcliffe has now launched a GoFundMe specifically to purchase and update a second camera, a pole to reach across his room, the ability to do a top shot, some improved audio and lighting, and just spatial improvements. I'm excited about this. I think the progression of your channel, Alex, despite the fact that you started off genuinely fairly rough.
Wow.
The progression of your channel to allow you to play games with your wife, with friends who are coming over, and get some gear that you have needed for a while in order to update what you're doing. I can't wait to see what you're going to be able to bring to the channel moving forward. And any of those listening to the podcast, swing over to the GoFundMe. There is a video on Board Game Co's, and he didn't know I was bringing this in, by the way. There's a video on Board Game Co's channel that talks about purchasing the new gear. It was put up maybe a week ago. And then there's also a GoFundMe. If you search Radcliffe Board Game Co. new camera gear, you've raised probably about 70% of what you need in order to make these purchases. And I'm excited, like I said, to see what you're going to be able to improve and bring moving forward into 2021.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing this in. You know, like, I'll be serious and not give you a hard time like you normally would.
Your entire list is the stuff that I said, hey, if you want to step it up a notch, here's what you should get.
Yeah, so something I've talked about here and there for a while, the concept of doing playthroughs on the channel, and every single time I have, I've had people express an interest in seeing them. The problem with doing playthroughs is that you really need a top shot. You can't do, I mean, I can kind of get away with it in my reviews of doing a front forward shot only and just focusing on the conversation with a visual glimpse of the components. But for a playthrough, you really need to be able to alternate back and forth, which effectively means that I have been constricted by not having the equipment. And so eventually, 2021 is a thing, and I've always am trying to continuously add to things I do on the channel. And so eventually I said it's time, and I'm ready to do it. And the problem is, ready to do is one thing, but it is $4,500 worth of new equipment to effectively be able to complement the gear I have now and to do the playthroughs. And so, yeah, I threw up a GoFundMe. I appreciate the support. I appreciate the call out from yourself, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes. Mm.
Cool.
Yeah, for anyone that's listening, here'd be the element that I'd point out. If you enjoy the content that we make, from the podcast to the YouTube content to the reviews and research on Kickstarter things, $1, $5, $100, all of that goes to you. If you're already consuming our content, you're investing in what Alex is able to do moving forward in this space. So swing over to the video or swing over to the link. If you go to theweeklyquack.com, there'll be a direct link to the GoFundMe. And like I said, he didn't know I was bringing this in, but I've donated, and I think you should too.
And so again, in all seriousness, Jesse, I do appreciate you bringing that in. But for this week's particular thing, speaking of playthroughs, I guess, let's tie it together that way. Speaking of playthroughs, today I'm bringing in Bloodstone, a game that's currently on Kickstarter by Druid City Games. This is going to be the latest from James Hudson, a giant epic skirmish game of rolling dice, attacking each other, playing cards, doing hordes of damage as you level up, as you get different abilities, as you just manage to roll triples in a row, in a row, in a row, three times in a row. The insanity of that was absolutely in. I mean, this is a game
I'm a little embarrassed that you got your math wrong, though.
I'm a little embarrassed too. I'd rather not talk about it, honestly. I feel like I made a whole big deal about betting it right and I got it slightly wrong, but we'll ignore that. But yeah, Bloodstone's going to be a giant skirmish game with PvE modes and PvP modes. You can play it cooperatively, competitively. You can have 1 to 8 players in an arena slugging it out with various different terrain effects, various different thingies that you can use to basically change up the game or change up how you play, or just the giant spinning wheel of death. Or you can play it cooperatively, playing against 8 different bosses as you go through a, not so much a campaign as a connected scenario, so to speak, as you go through each of these bosses and figure out their own unique advantages or weaknesses or how they play so you can take advantage of the game. But if you enjoy the premise, if you enjoy the idea of hordes of damage being dealt, of unstoppable combinations, of horrific moments when you just can't manage to roll, if all those things appeal to you, you should be checking out Bloodstone.
Here's what I'm going to say. Take the best parts of dice chucking Dice Thrones and put it into a skirmish game. And it's really good. Alex and I have done a mix of content on this, from a variety of gameplay videos to a preview to a full review, and both of us have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this game.
And okay, so that's what I want to kind of hear more about, because out of everything I've seen so far of this game, it definitely looks interesting and it looks like fun, but I just can't put my finger on what makes it different from other skirmish games. Like, sure, I see that there's like the dice throne element in here, and then you also have the pool building, but is that really all that there is to this game?
There you go. You nailed it. Excellent.
Okay, really? Is that all? But what about...
No, that's it.
Yeah, but what about other skirmish games?
Such as what? Tell me what else is out there.
Well, like Super Fantasy Brawl, for example.
Super Fantasy Brawl does... So you're not wrong, but Super Fantasy Brawl is going to have a few differences. The first of all is cards versus dice chucking. People may have their preferences. I do think, despite that, both of them do give you the same feel. But at a very straight baseline, I would say Super Fantasy Brawl focuses on a two-player experience that is very objective-focused, versus sort of Bloodstone focuses on a 1-to-8 player PvE, or a 1-to-who-knows-how-many-player PvP, so either way around, PvE versus PvP, focus on just sheer damage output. So they definitely share overlap. In fact, if I were comparing any game to Bloodstone, my first pick would be Super Fantasy Brawl.
Okay.
But I would say the way I've been answering the question when asked is, if somebody is primarily playing a game two players, I would recommend Super Fantasy Brawl. But if they are playing with a variable player count, then Bloodstone's just Bloodstone is just far more variable in what it can do.
Okay, sure. I hear that about the player counts being huge. That's definitely a really different take from other skirmish games that I've seen. But beyond that, what exactly makes Bloodstone unique from all the others, like Arena? You have Giga Robo, you have, as I just said, Super Fantasy Bro. Like, what exactly about this particular game just makes it one that I should consider in a marketplace that already has so many different fighting head-to-head games?
Dice rolling. So, like, we've had swings that feel really great, we've had swings that feel really bad, and then we've had moments that feel, you know, average, like everything's equal. Dice rolling provides a variability that some people like and some people don't. But for myself, the sequence of triple threes that Alex and I experienced, combined with the fact that we played a PvP session where one super powerful strike wiped out the entire battlefield and secured me the victory, should answer your question.
Well, but at the same time, like, that actually makes me worry. What about dice mitigation in this?
The mitigation in this game is going to come in from a few different stances. The first most, which is going to apply to both cooperative and competitive, is the idea that as you roll poorly, you don't actually mitigate your results.
You just get super powerful.
Exactly. You get to level up. You get to add more dice to your pool. You get abilities that will help you throughout the rest of the game. That's going to be one thing. The second is going to be, if you're playing at PvP, the other form of mitigation is not going to come from the game, but rather the players. If one player is having a bit of a dominant effect, I guarantee you the other players will sit there and figure out how to become friends for the short time necessary that it takes to wipe people out.
That's why this game plays so well at higher player counts, because it's a skirmish arena combat game that features easy-to-access mechanics and a surface-level degree of conversation that allows you to negotiate, target, and reposition where you're focusing your damage, your attack. Unlike Dice Thrones, when you're playing against four people and you're forced to target the highest health point, this gives you the opportunity to really mitigate and make a decision between who's the biggest threat, who's aiding you, who's been nice to you, and who's potentially going to be winning the game.
So what you're saying is that somebody's going to kingmake you eventually when we play, right? So okay, let me get this clear, because I know that in certain skirmish games, there's this opportunity to respawn and constantly come back. Based on what you're saying, is this a knockout game? Basically, like, once you're off the board, you're like permanently off?
No, they're out of the game. You're correct.
Wow. So how exactly, like, how quickly does this game move forward? Because I can imagine getting knocked out really early. Like, I could potentially convince the entire table to go against someone.
If you, sir, are able to convince the entire table to act against their own best interests and take out a player when they shouldn't, then you are very good at what you're doing. More often than not, though, you'll find that players will be eliminated as the game progresses, as it hits that end game. There'll certainly be exceptions, but I think an entire game of Bloodstone will come in at under an hour on a regular basis. And generally, I'd say
shorter than that.
Yeah, I think even shorter. Allowing for some degree of length.
Our duo co-op consistently hit 40 minutes. A PvP where everyone knows the game session, I think you could sprint through that in 30.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that's reasonable.
I'd say I'm gauging that off of four players.
Okay, so at the end of the day, I think this game does definitely have a lot of things going for it, but I think it's important that we mention kind of like the things that probably won't be great for a lot of people. You know, you got player elimination here, you have very little dice mitigation at all, where a game that's mostly dependent on big rolls and being able to have exploding dice, like, what else might be wrong for some other people right now? Because
There is the price tag.
Oh, yeah. The price tag is absolutely crazy for this.
Alex, you're the most equipped to talk about this.
So regarding the price tag is going to be an interesting one, because offhand, I will say that as a Kickstarter exclusive game, as a Kickstarter exclusive game that is very good, this will almost certainly hold its value. And the options are Kickstarter, the next Kickstarter, conventions where it will cost more, or the secondhand market. There's not a lot of room for getting this game cheaply past what the price is going to be. So I believe it will do just fine in holding its value. As far as comparing it to what your other options are, it is coming in on the price your side. There's no question about that. In terms of the amount of content you get, just in terms of little physical content compared to other games, it is on the pricier side, but it's also not crazy out there. Looking at Super Fantasy Brawl again as the closest comparison, Super Fantasy Brawl is coming in at roughly half the price for like the basic entry level of giving you, I think it gave 12 heroes, so it gave you even more heroes. But also that gave you only a two-player experience. It didn't give you variable arena stuff. It didn't give you 8 cooperative bosses to go through one at a time. So when you're comparing it to those games, game to game, I think you're getting a lot more content, a lot more game out of Bloodstone. But yes, it does come with a heavier price tag. Overall, I would say this is one that will do a just fine job holding its value. But if you are someone who's looking at it from a stance of what goes into your own collection and whether this is the right pick versus any number of other games, you're going to have to sit there and look at those games and ask yourself which one you want more and which one are you willing to pay for, because this is a reasonably priced game, but also not incredibly, you know, competitive or cheap in terms of the Kickstarter landscape right now.
like, the last thing I'll say about Bloodstone before moving forward is that I'm just going to echo what everybody else has been saying, even though it's kind of already burnt out, but this game just looks like a ton of fun. Honestly, like, everything I've seen so far just looks like a raucous good time. But either way, today for On the Radar, I'm bringing Stroganov, published by Game Brewers and designed by Andreas Stedding, designer of Hansa Teutonica, Gugon, and Firenze.
I am so interested in this game, Jan. I literally have back this project in front of my mouse button.
Okay.
I'm ready for you to convince me.
Are you really, sir?
I mean, I do currently have... I don't lie.
Well, what about this game makes you interested in it? This doesn't seem like your type of game.
I love the title, and the cover is beautiful.
Jesse loves Euros.
Oh, I see. I never paid attention to this, but I see what's on the cover now.
It is gorgeous. There is a stag being hunted by two men on steeds going down a rolling valley with mist in the background and beautiful fall leaves painting the landscape.
Yeah, honestly, it kind of reminds me of Scythe a little bit, right? Doesn't it have that sheen?
I would buy this to hang it on my wall.
Yeah, it's also, Jesse, this is done by the same artist as Predaporter. It's the same dude.
I'm not as interested in that.
Well, either way, so Stroganov, as I said, published by Game Bros, designed by Andreas Stedding, is set in the 16th century when Russia began to expand eastwards to develop the vast expanses of Siberia. In the game, players are trying to collect the best furs to gain wealth and fame as they move across the vastness of Siberia. They will journey through Siberia in spring, summer, and autumn before returning home each winter. After four rounds, the player who has best utilized their actions and collected the most victory points is going to win. Each round, the players must move eastward across the landscape. They can spend horses if they wish to travel further. Once they have advanced, they may take a basic action or more advanced action. All of these different actions earn players victory points at the end of the game. After four rounds, the game ends, and then players score victory points based on everything they've collected and or accomplished. And the player, obviously, with the most points at the end is going to win. And I don't know about you guys, but for some reason, this seriously reminds me of like a more advanced or Euro-y version of Parks. Is it just me?
I'm less interested.
How is this like Parks? That's an interesting comparison.
Well, like it is very abstract in the way that I'm trying to compare them. It's very loose, but essentially you're trying to move forward through these changing landscapes all the time, and you're also trying to collect different types of resources. Obviously, in Parks, it's more like sights and beautiful memories and things like that. Here in Stroganov, you're collecting the furs, right? I think beyond that comparison, it's a little bit more shaky. Like I said, it's a very superficial comparison. But ultimately, what Stroganov is doing that I think is actually really, really interesting is that you're trying to kind of go as fast as possible or as distant as possible into Siberia to try and get better bonuses and better things. Like similar actually to a game I have called Terramara, in this game you don't necessarily get a penalty for going too far. You just have to pay a lot of resources to do it. And the advantages of doing that is that you get particular actions. One of the more interesting things that was actually mentioned by Man vs. Meeple in this is that the variability in Stroganov is absolutely ridiculously gigantic. So every single game that you're playing, absolutely everything on the board is going to be completely different, which means that you may have to push farther and farther to get the exact action you need versus that other game that you just played, where maybe it was almost at the beginning of the game. In addition to that, each one of the zones is going to contain actions that are going to constantly start shifting out. For example, the yurts in here are temporary actions that are there, or even objective cards that you can get, and these cards constantly shift downwards, but only when other people earlier in the track order take those cards.
I, uh,
Uh-huh.
I don't need to back it. That's okay.
Oh, well.
It's interesting, because everything you described actually makes me far more interested in this game than I was before. Stroganoff, for me, falls in the category of another heavy, fairly expensive Euro on Kickstarter. And, yep. And don't get me wrong, this is the wrong opinion to have. But generally, I don't think of Kickstarter as the place where I get my Euro games. I think of it as the place where I get my Ameritrashes, my hybrids, my mm-hmm. a whole different genre of game. And between having Carnegie recently, between having Darwin's Journey, and now Stroganoff, all entering that, like, you know, $80 price point for a Euro, I just found myself entering, I guess, Euro, overpriced Euro fatigue on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And I genuinely did not pay that much attention to this game. But everything you're saying, I mean, the idea of a heavier Parks is incredibly appealing to me.
I already have Parks.
Yeah, but it's not the same thing. Like, there's honestly so much happening here.
If it isn't, I will send you an invoice for the money I paid for this game.
Ooh, that's fair.
Well, okay. Well, I don't know if I agree to those terms 100%.
I didn't hear anything about the story that I was playing.
Well, that's the thing, Jesse. Like, at the end of the day, this is still a heavy Euro. Like, it's still very dry. But with that said, you know, like, it is a fairly thematic one, right? Like, this idea that you're journeying through Siberia, you're basically the sons and daughters of the monarch, of the king of this area, and of the czar, and you're trying to basically get songs made about you and stories written in your name to basically have the greatest adventure out of all your siblings. It's actually pretty interesting the way that they kind of adapted that into a linear board.
I'm looking closer, and it really does look like Parks.
Yeah, right? I know. But again, like, it's not necessarily going to be the same thing, but I definitely feel there's, like, I don't know what the term would be. It's more like the DNA that Parks established. Like, one of the main differences from a game like Parks, beyond it being just much more complex and having a breadth of actions, is that in this game, the player that is farthest ahead is the player that's going to go first. So that starts adding a lot of really interesting tension into this game, where in Parks, obviously, whoever's the last is going to take advantage of something that's also done in Glenmore. Another change that I think is really, really fascinating here is that this game is played in four rounds, like I said, seasons, and every time that you get towards winter, you're also going to reset your location on the map. So if you were trying your very best to get to the end of the landscape, at the end of this board, you're gonna have to plan ahead a lot.
So I can't speak for the strategy. I just like the promise. I just like the idea of the game based on the way you sold this game.
How about this, Alex? You back it, send Jan an invoice if it turns out to not be what you're expecting.
That sounds like an excellent plan. I will send Quackalope an invoice.
I don't remember agreeing about this at all at any point.
There's nothing to agree to. I already hit back.
With all that being said, I'm bringing in a little known game called Badland Wolves.
Ooh, isn't this the one that you've been talking about even in Board Game Barbecue?
We did talk
did
about this
really?
In the Board Game Barbecue podcast, which was our first guest star in another podcast.
Are you going on podcasts without me?
And
does this podcast mean nothing to you?
A good experience. I gotta say, the guys over from Australia in the Board Game Barbecue are putting on one excellent heck of a show.
Yeah,
and
it's really good.
Not having Alex there probably made it slightly better. If you want to go listen to...
Honestly, I've done my segments. I've done my Shelf or Sell. I've done my On the Radar, my Medley Minute. I think you don't need
Alex,
me for this.
Oh, here's on, what Alex. I'll say. Here's what I'll say.
Stop.
The Board Game Barbecue invited Quackalope on... They didn't invite Board Game Co.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's right. I wasn't really doing anything, and suddenly Jesse goes like, "Hey, Jan, you want to jump into a podcast?" And that's kind of how it happened. It wasn't really planned.
Listen, I'm just throwing it out there that the Board Game Barbecue had no interest in having Alexander Radcliffe from Board Game Co. invited onto their show. And in case anyone's wondering why
I'm leaning...
I once
upon a time had lots of positive feelings towards Australians, and
come on.
In case anyone's wondering why I'm leaning into this joke... We're currently recording in our Discord community, and one of the Board Game Barbecue boys is currently listening in
this
recording session.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
That is incredibly amusing, because I did not realize that's who it was.
Yeah, it's Mike.
And so, Mike, thank you for having us. And maybe you should reach out to Alex, because I bet he'd come join. All that being said, bringing in a game called Badland Wolves. It is a little tiny indie game currently standing at 337 backers with 10 days to go at the time of this recording, meaning that those of you that listen to this podcast should take my word for it and go ahead and back this game immediately.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, I guess that's all.
I should probably specify the game and the experience of the game.
Yeah.
In Badland Wolves, which is designed by a single designer and also drawn and illustrated by that same designer, an incredible Ukrainian designer who lives here in Kentucky that I didn't actually realize, but I went to high school with.
What? Really?
Yes,
that's super insane.
Super cool. I'm doing coverage on my channel. We have a full interview, and there's a lot of stuff I learned in that process. He knew me at my stage of like hanging up posters around the school with positive messages on them.
Yeah,
all that being said, we'll skip over that very quickly. All that being said, Badland Wolves is going to be a complex game where you're squabbling to take control of a wolf pack after the alpha leader has died. Each of you represents a different wolf, and your dynamic is trying to take little chits or little wooden pieces that represent your favor or your influence from the other wolves around the table. There's going to be two core stacks of cards that you'll cycle through as you play this game. The first is going to be the hunt stack, where you're going to introduce one of your influence tokens to show that you're going on the hunt and then draw a card. Those cards could be a boar, a wild stag, a jackalope, or a bear, leading to positive or negative results for everyone that has taken part in that hunt excursion. The second stack of cards is going to be the resource stack or the scrap stack. These cards are going to have a degree of set collection, but then also cards that function for a showdown or attack phase of the game, where you're able to bite, nip, and yip at the other players around the table, doing your very best to steal their influence tokens and bring them over into your own pool. This is a lightweight game that is easily accessible and plays 3 to 5. It is also a game that gives me the feeling of a social deduction game without heavy social deduction elements. You're still reading the room, negotiating between players, and trying to solve the balance of who's controlling the wolf pack or who will end up on the top of the heap. One of the things that I love about this game, and honestly, the innovation that I think makes this game so special, is the fact that your influence tokens that you have in front of you, that pool, can be utilized no matter whose tokens you have. So if I wanted to put at risk or sacrifice another player's token that I own, I can send it out on a hunt. Or if I want to fight my opponent and do my best to win a battle in order to steal the third or fourth player's resource token or influence token, I can do that as well. This creates a changing and dynamic landscape at the table, where you're always doing your best to figure out who owns your resources, who might put them at risk, and how you negotiate this space in order to end up owning a dominance of all of them.
Oh, dude, and it's so beautiful. Like, I'm looking at everything and wow.
It's so pretty.
It's so pretty.
The very first thing that I checked when I was reached out to about this title was the artwork. It has this old school silhouette Greek style. You know, it looks like it would have been painted on the walls of Troy. It's so beautiful and so well done. And the care and attention to detail that's been placed into it, I am biased on behalf of love letters to our industry. And if this isn't a love letter to the space, to games, to what they mean for a family and a family unit, I have a full interview going up with the designer Daniel Gorash and his brother, but his family were first-generation immigrants from the Ukraine here into the States, and growing up without a TV, without electronics, they always used to invent and design and create little games for themselves to play. And so this is his love letter to himself, the past that he had, the community that he grew up in, this culture that still exists here in the States of immigrant families that are all doing their very best to work and play and build this strong familial union. I'm really, really charmed by this game, not only because I think the designer and publisher and creator of it deserves all the support I can give him, but also because the game's good. I played 3 sessions of it in a single night, and have been left wanting to play it ever since then.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about it, but it kind of reminds me of the Resistance for some reason.
Interesting. How so?
So, I'm probably just comparing this to the overarching genre of mission-based social deduction games. But, you know, in the Resistance, you're all kind of like planning and holding cards close to your chest and going on missions together and trying to see what happens, right? Like what the result of that mission, of that shared experience is going to be. Then suddenly here in Badlands Wolves, that actually becomes resources that you're fighting over. So it's not just now the consequence of the mission, if it's either successful or unsuccessful. Now it's mostly like my life points, my entire goal in this game is being given out and distributed out to different people. And I also really like kind of like that more abstract nature to it, how you incorporate the cards and how you're able to I don't know, like evolve and plan out your turns. It just seems really cool.
It's got that abstract of social deduction, pressure, luck, and strategic gameplay, and it just feels and is balanced very well.
Yeah, Jesse, color me intrigued. I mean, the game is, the art, like you said already, it does look beautiful. It sounds unique in terms of what it's bringing to the table. It's one that I'm definitely keeping an eye on. I want to see where it plays up.
Yeah, this is one that I'm just super excited to share. And with that, we're going to move on to listener comments. We have a section at the end of the podcast where we do our very best to engage and have a conversation with you, the audience. And if you want to be featured or have your comment answered here on the show, swing over to theweeklyquack.com or our Facebook group and community, the Quackalope Podcast, and let us know your thoughts. If your question is interesting or controversial enough, we'll be sure to avoid it. If your question is, you know, just about average, we'll bring it in and answer it.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.
Okay, I just want to say for the record that no question is average.
So I'm bringing in a question and a comment and advice from Carl, who covers a few things. And first of all, I want to go into his advice or commentary, which is he talks about the idea that on our request for listener comments, we have a bit of a barrier to entry in the fact that it is like seven clicks deep
from clicking through
the podcast Apple to episode description.
Oh, it's
the
terrible.
Website,
sure.
Expand, scroll. There's like a whole bunch of steps you have to go through to actually leave a comment. Jesse's gagging with how difficult and hard it is. And so Carl, you're not wrong. It's something that we need to take into account. It's something we have been discussing. We just don't have any ideal or perfect solutions.
I haven't found a good solution for... We use Squarespace as our website hosting tool. And so far, now we haven't dug in a ton just due to time constraints and everything like that. But I haven't found a good solution to how we can open up that space to allow comments more easily and accessibly. We need to look into it deeper, but I'm bugged by it every time I go to comment. You're not wrong.
Yeah, same here.
It might be something we end up experimenting with, perhaps utilizing our Facebook group and pin posts. There are different options we have on the table.
Our Facebook group is up to about 720 members. We have some good engagement happening there. And so if you're bugged by the website, swing over to the Quackalope Facebook group or the Quackalope Podcast Facebook group and join us there, because that's an easy way to have a conversation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And so that's helpful, Carl. I appreciate it. But that said, I don't want to ignore your actual questions, because I thought they were quick and interesting. A trio of questions for all of us, as it were. And to begin with, the first question is, what's the last book you read and finished?
Oh my god.
This is an interesting one. The last physical book I read and finished.
You added the word physical. He did not.
Okay. No, that's what I was saying. The last digital book I read and finished is probably going to be the Bobiverse series that's a Audible exclusive. It's a sci-fi fiction book where you journey through a space where humans have basically destroyed themselves and one little AI or human personality has been injected into an AI system called Bob. And he starts reiterating on himself, self-replicating, and the dynamics of how people change from one stage to another, you know, as different generations of this same person evolve is really, really interesting. That being said, the last physical book that I read and finished is probably going to be 12 Rules for Life by Jordan B. Peterson, a book that helped shape and script my approach and experience of the world, especially when I was processing and dealing with a substantial breakup. I could not highly recommend it enough, and it is one that I am very quickly going to be diving back into for, I believe, a fourth time.
Ooh, fourth time. That's impressive. Although, speaking
twice,
of fourth time.
Twice audible, once physical.
So my last book that I read and finished is going to be Pillars of the Earth, maybe a month or two ago, where I've read that book. I think this was my fifth or sixth time finishing it.
Wow.
It is my favorite book of all time, bar none. And
I
went in for another.
I haven't started it.
You, sir, should definitely read that book.
I purchased it because of you.
Oh, I know. I remember the conversation. But Pillars of the Earth, it's actually a board game as well. Although the board game is good, the book is amazing. Chan, what about yourself?
This is a horrible question. I don't read. I never read. I don't do much reading.
Wait, wait.
It's horrible.
There's other little questions, Jan. Dr. There's
Seuss
other little
counts.
Questions.
Is Dr. Alex... Seuss is the last book you read and finished? It counts.
No, silly. It's not Dr. Seuss. Like, the last book I remember trying to read was The Wind-Up Chronicles from Haruki Murakami, which I heard that was really, really good.
Excellent. What is the last board game you played?
Unicorn Fever.
Ooh, beautiful. Jesse, yourself?
Last board game I played is going to be Fair is Foul and Foul is Fair, Badland Wolves.
Oh, okay.
Nice. For myself, it's going to be the fourth episode of Clank, the fourth mission of Clank Legacy.
Ooh.
And then finally...
You're going to bring that in one day.
Yeah,
for sure. One day indeed. And finally, last
How
movie
dare
you watched...
How play it without me?
Last movie you watched at the cinema.
Why are all these so tough? Gosh darn it.
At the cinema.
I do remember.
I believe the last movie I saw at the cinema, the cinnamon, is The Joker, which I thought was a incredible reflection and introduction into the way that our society treats those with mental health problems. And I left that movie inspired to cause a little bit of chaos.
Yeah, I really liked it.
So for me, it's going to be Frozen 2 with my family. That was the last movie we actually made our way to the theater for. And then we don't go off that often. We go like maybe, three, four times a year.
With a family of 16, it's an expensive trip.
It's an expensive trip, exactly. And so that would be it. Frozen 2 is going to be my last movie at the theater before the world went crazy.
Ah, oh, man, I like people have to understand that I don't have a good memory. I don't remember.
That wasn't the question.
I know it wasn't the question, but I can't remember these things. Like, I barely remember what game I just brought at the beginning of the show.
I'm just going to make a disproving sound again.
Okay, whatever. Let's move over to the next question, which is actually from a new person I haven't seen ask a question before. So Gabriel Z asked, what's a game that you have house ruled?
Ooh,
all of them. I don't think I've ever played a game right.
No, that's okay. Messing up the rules is not the same thing as house ruling,
Jesse.
Okay,
good clarification there.
So for me, one of them that's going to kind of fall into this category is going to be Zombicide. Zombicide is a game that I play by the official rules, but I frequently mess around with things in terms of the difficulty levels in order to be able to add as much of the extra content from Kickstarters as possible while also maintaining the balance of the game. I find that I just kind of make up my own set of rules as to how the content gets added in a way that's not too hard, not too easy, and just kind of works. So I don't really worry about what you're supposed to do so much as how do I get four extra abominations, but also all the artifacts and also all the walkers and the runners and the wolves, because I want to have a crazy little game going on and I want to do it in a way that is fun for me.
I don't find that I currently play games repetitively enough due to the nature of the work that we do to allow me to need to house rule them. If a game doesn't work well off of the core mechanics, I move on to one that does.
Yeah, I think I do the exact same thing. The only exception to that is, this is more general for all games that do this, like modular deck systems, I kind of absolutely hate. And what I tend to do...
I hate that.
Yeah, what I tend to do is just like mix them all up and just play. It's just
like
much
what?
Easier.
What's an example?
Deus and Deus Egypt, Thunderstone. There's a whole bunch of these games.
I haven't played those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Unicorn
Fever.
Fever
does have that. You're right. I would do that with Unicorn Fever. I should not listen to their rule set.
It's easier.
We have a comment from Mike, again, from the Board Game Barbecue podcast.
Oh.
I'm a huge Zombicide player, and I tend to sometimes house rule simplifying zombie turns and how they move.
Okay.
I don't have more context into how he does that, but I mean,
No. That's because he's not on the show, but this is going to be a quick preview into the fact that the Board Game Barbecue boys, well, they're coming. They're coming onto our podcast at some point.
Oh,
soon.
For sure.
No, but I do generally find that lighter games
like
Zombicide,
stampede of gazelle.
There's far more focus on having fun than anything else. And so you should always do what you can to just make the experience a better experience.
Yeah, I hear that. I guess like what's the line between when we do house rule something and when we don't house rule something? Like I'm never very clear.
So I will say this is interesting. I actually have a full video at some point coming on this subject because I found that for me, the common denominator is that cooperative or solo games, I am far more willing to house rule versus competitive experiences. I find that the level of balance required to make sure they work, that's where I usually don't touch it at all.
Yeah. Okay, I hear that.
I don't touch most things. I just get things wrong. I have a comment from Shira who wanted to ask our community, the wider community, whether or not Blood Rage or Inish were the best title.
Ooh, so this is going to be going off that video we all did.
It is going off the video where we all collectively ruled that, of course, Bloodstone wins.
So, Blood Rage, sir. So, the three of us all voted Blood Rage in the end. But I am curious what the general community believes. Similarly, it's been a while since we did our last poll on games that are better. I believe last time it was Wingspan or Everdell.
Wingspan
did not win that one. Yeah. But I am curious what the general community thinks. Because I know across Board Game Geek or even across the Dice Tower, I know the Dice Tower, when they did the top 100, the only five-way crossover was Blood Rage. So, well, I'm inclined to believe that Blood Rage wins, but let's find out.
Let's toss a poll up for the community to interact with on the Quackalope Podcast Facebook group to see what they think.
Yeah, I'm down. And perhaps if things go crazily enough, perhaps a confirmation bias is in the works.
Ooh, that would be really fun. Yeah, I've always been a fan of Blood Rage, so I guess I would probably vote
that. I'm voting for Blood Rage, and I'm assuming the general audience is.
I didn't like Inish.
Wait, you didn't like Inish at all? Like zero?
No, not really.
Wow. Okay. Well, I kind of find that surprising. You know, I was looking at the video that you guys made, and I started seeing that a lot of people
were. You don't watch our videos?
Yes, I do. Sometimes I do. What do you mean?
Don't lie to the audience? What are you talking about?
Stop it.
How dare you?
Point is that I saw that a lot of the comments started skewing closer to Inish, which I was like a little bit surprised with, honestly.
I don't think that's true either.
Well, I don't know. I just kind of skimmed through it. I just looked at it from like a cursory view. It was really quick. It seemed like it was mostly Inish. So I don't know. I'm curious to see what happens at the end of the day.
Well, and with on that note, knowing that Jan is willing to lie to the audience on behalf of how much of my content he consumes.
I'm not lying.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining the Quackalope Podcast. We're going to go have a deep and theoretical conversation about what house rules we should impose because we're about to be roommates. Let us know for next week episode, what house rules would you include if you were moving in with one of your best friends?